My name is Greg. One of my responsibilities this morning is to bring truth and encouragement to help us along the way. And so what I'd like to do is start off with a couple truths here. The state of Iowa has four major universities. The state of California has, I believe, 34. Currently, three of our universities are in the tournament, and California has none. Okay? Just saying. State of Iowa has 1% of the nation's population, and currently we have 10% of the brackets have our name on it. So there we go. All God's people said.
Amen.
There we go. Should we pray and go home, get ready for the TV later on today, this morning? Yeah. I had one of the ushers go, "We're not doing third service, are we?" We're just not. I said, "We don't have to. Brooks is gone, man. We can make decisions." So we're going to continue on with our look in the Gospel of John. And over the last number of weeks, what we've been doing is we've been looking at this narrative going through John's Gospel, where Jesus is arrested and he's brought before the authorities and he's going through various trials. And this morning we're going to see getting towards the end of those trials, where Jesus is going to be standing before Pilate for the civil trial, and the narrative and the discourse that's going to be going on. And just to kind of bring you up to speed, you know, where we've been, and you know, Jesus was arrested, and then he was taken before Annas, who used to be the high priest, and he was forced to step down, but Annas was still viewed as a leading authority figure in the town, and so they brought him before Annas, and that was just unproductive for the religious leaders. And so then they decided to take him to Caiaphas. Caiaphas was Annas' son-in-law. And what we saw there was just a mockery of a trial. False witnesses were brought to make accusations against Jesus. They accused him. The one true thing that came out of it is they said, "You claim to be the Son of God." And it's like, yep, that's true. But they said, no, that's blasphemy. And so Caiaphas tore his robes and, you know, as a sign that this is blasphemy, God's being cursed and things like that. So then they said, you know, he deserves to die, but we're going to take him before Pilate, who was the Roman governor in Jerusalem at the time, and for the civil trial. And so he's before Pilate, and as we saw last time, Jesus has been roughed up a little bit. It's still the middle of the night. It's somewhere between 3 and 6 o'clock in the morning. So it's done really kind of secretively, so people don't know what's going on. And they bring him before Pilate, and you know, Pilate says, "Are you a king?" And he says, "Hey, you said it, you know, not me. Yes, I am a king. My kingdom's not of this world, though." And Pilate says, "You know, he's not guilty." And the Jewish leaders, they start stirring the pot, and then he just says, "Well, what's truth?" And Jesus talks to him. Jesus has a few tidbits to say. But what we find is that as we're going to continue on with this narrative, is that we find that Pilate is finding himself in a real jam here. You see, Pilate is placed there by the Roman authorities as an authority figure of Rome to keep the peace. And this is really kind of a hotbed, Jerusalem. And so he is put there. It's like, look, keep the peace. No insurgencies, no insurrections, you know, those sorts of things. Pilate knows he's in a pickle because after he's roughened up Jesus a little bit, he goes, "Look, you have a law that says, you know, I can release one of the prisoners over the Passover." And they say, "We'll take Barabbas. We'll take the one who's guilty of insurrection, murder, robber, the one who has been kind of like a catalyst of insurrections. We want him." So Pilate, I think, is beginning to understand he's got a real problem on his hand, because if he does not keep the peace, then he becomes a problem with the Roman authorities, and now his job is on the line. So as we look at the narrative, there are some things I want us to keep in mind as we go through this entire narrative through this part of the chapter. These are some things that are going on. Always keep these things in mind. First of all, the Jewish religious leaders, they are extremely afraid of Jesus. They want him dead, they want him gone, but they want someone else to do the dirty work. They are afraid of Jesus. Pilate is afraid of the Jews. And as we find out, Pilate is going to get more and more agitated, more and more stirred up, and more fearful about what's going on with the Jewish leaders and the crowds that are starting to gather, okay? The Jewish leaders are afraid. Pilate's afraid. But as we go through this narrative, keep this in mind. Jesus isn't afraid of anyone. Sometimes we look at this and it's easy to gloss over it, okay? Jesus is not a martyr that's going to die a martyr's death to start a revolution. Jesus is on mission. He knows what he's there for. He volunteered for this task. He knows what he's doing. And he, throughout this whole thing, is not afraid of anyone. Some other things that we're going to see. Universal truth here, okay? If you want to see what's in a tube, squeeze it, okay? Dr. Hart back there, he's been preaching this message for years. If you want to see what's in a tube, squeeze it. If you want to see what's in a person, watch what comes out when they're squeezed. We're going to see Pilate being squeezed, the religious leaders being squeezed. We're going to see Jesus being squeezed. Watch what comes out. The other thing is that power does not corrupt. It reveals. There's a popular saying in our society that says, well, power corrupts. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's not necessarily true. Power does not corrupt. Power reveals. If you have someone who's got a corrupt heart and you give them authority, responsibility, power, it'll reveal that heart. You have one who is perfect, no corruption, holy, powerful, like the Lord Jesus, who has all authority that's been handed over to him. He uses that power to reveal his heart. He blesses. He includes us. He does things that are beneficial. A heart that has been changed when given power reveals itself. A heart that's corrupt when given power and authority, it reveals itself. And we'll see that in the narrative as it goes on. Okay? The other thing is that we're going to find out is that those not on trial can be found guilty. As we'll go through this narrative, we'll find out, well, Jesus is the one on trial, but when this is all over, we're going to find out that the guilty party is Pilate and the religious leaders. So, let's go on. If you have a Bible, turn to John chapter 19. If you don't have one, we have the scriptures on the screen, so just pay attention. So it's going to start out here. Things are getting stirred up and heated up. Pilate knows that he's in a pickle. He doesn't want an insurrection to start. They want an insurrection to be released from prison. So he says, Pilate, therefore, took Jesus and scourged him. Okay? Now, scourging was a Roman punishment. It was really, really unique to the Romans. The Jews could whip somebody, but they could not scourge someone. And scourging is different than whipping, okay? This is what a scourge was. It was like a cat of nine tails, but what it had is on the ends of it and throughout it would have like sharp objects, pieces of metal, bone, maybe rocks, things that are just real sharp. The purpose of scourging is to lash the whips across the back of the guilty party. Those would then embed in the flesh, and then you would pull it and rake it across the back. So it actually started digging into the flesh of the person who was being scourged. The Jews were not allowed by law to scourge anybody. They could whip somebody with a lash, okay? In fact, it would say that you could give 39 lashes. 39 lashes was like one short of death. 40 lashes, if you were to receive that punishment, meant you're going to be whipped until you die. 39 means we're going to beat you to about an inch of your life. Scourging is much different. First of all, the Jews couldn't scourge anyone. The Romans would not scourge one of their own. The Romans could not scourge a Roman citizen. You could be a Roman citizen and you could be found guilty for the most heinous crimes, the most incredibly barbaric crimes, and you would not be scourged. Scourging was a barbaric practice that was reserved for those who are not Romans. The other thing is that history tells us is that it was more than likely that the Roman 10th Legion or garrison was the one who was occupying Jerusalem at this point. One of the things that was unique about the 10th Legion or garrison that was occupying was that there was a great deal of mercenary soldiers in there, which means that they were not Romans. They were soldiers for hire. So, well, why is that important? Because soldiers for hire, they're in it for the money. They have no conscience. They could do the most barbaric acts either in battle or to keep the peace, and it didn't bother their conscience at all. More than likely, it was one of these kind of soldiers, one of these kinds in the legion, that was called upon to scourge Jesus. The other thing that was true with scourging is that there was no limit. The Jews would say, look, we're going to stop at 39. The Romans said, look, game on. We're going to go until we say it's time to stop. It would start, and no one knew when it was going to end. Medical practices have shown us, when they have studied the scourging that Jesus underwent, others that had undergone something similar, it said, because his back was ripped open to such an extent that if you wanted to, while the victim was still alive, you could take your fingers in between the seams and start to spread it open and start to see internal organs. That's how bad scourging was. The other thing about scourging is that when we think as Christians, when we look at the gospel narrative, and it's like, it's Jesus on the cross that took away our sins. That it was on the cross where the judgment of the Father for the sins of mankind fell upon his Son as the sacrifice. That is true. I don't want to take anything away from that. But I also believe that when Jesus started to undergo this part of his punishment, that this was also part of the penalty of our sins. The scriptures tell us that it's by his wounds or his stripes that we are healed. Well, what stripes would those be? They were the stripes on his back and his side. You see, this was not just something separate from the cross. It was this package deal where the Son of God would endure this barbaric murder as he offered up himself as a living sacrifice to atone for the sin of mankind. It says, Pilate therefore scourged him, and then that's not enough. See, I think what Pilate is trying to do is, in the narrative before that, and as we'll see, he just goes, I find no guilt in this guy. What did he do? I find no guilt. And I think he's trying to appease then the Jewish religious leaders so that this insurrection wouldn't take place. So he scourges them. And then when he's done, the soldiers wove a crown of thorns and put it on his head. I mean, hasn't he suffered enough that they have to do this? And they arrayed him in a purple robe, purple being the color of a king. So think about this situation. Jesus has been scourged. His back has been ripped open. He's got blood all over the place. And then they put a garment on his back. Not only to mock him, because some think that he's a king, not only to humiliate him, but remember when he goes to the cross, and it said that the soldiers will then gamble for his garments. This is one of the garments. Can you imagine as the blood starts to dry and clot and stick to this robe and then they rip it off? It just rips the wounds open all over again. This is incredibly horrific. And they put, they say, Hail, King of the Jews. And then if that's not enough, they give him blows in the face. Now the word blows there means to hit with an open hand. It could mean, some believe it's like they're trying to hit him in the face with the palm of his hand. He's already been hit in the face with like rods and beams, okay? He's already been punched. He's already been beaten. But now after all this, now they're hitting him with the palm with an open hand. I tend to think that when you hit someone with an open hand, it's like a slap. When you see two guys that are having a discussion, and one guy slaps the other, what comes to your mind? What comes to mind, guys? Come on. Disgrace? Humiliation? A slap? Hey, boy, why don't you just go away? It's humiliating to get slapped. It's humiliating. It's mocking. It's ridiculing. And this is what they do to Jesus. They say, "Hail, King of the Jews." In the Old Testament, Isaiah records this. These are prophetic sayings about what the Messiah was to be like, what the Messiah will endure. Speaking prophetically about Jesus Christ in this time, it says in Isaiah chapter 50, he says, "I gave my back to those who strike me, and my cheeks to those who pluck out my beard." They pulled out his beard. Hey guys, can you just kind of go, "Ow, that hurts. I have to buy the sensitive formula shaving cream because I'm just such a sensitive guy. I can't imagine, first of all, I can't grow one, but if I did, to have it pulled out of my face, that rips the skin off your face." And then it says, "I did not cover my face from humiliation and spitting." Can you imagine spitting on someone and they don't cover their face? They just stare back at you? A couple years ago, my family and I, we watched a movie about a rugby team. These nice young men, buff, great athletes. Story about two teams. They met early in the movie outside the field. They were rivals, bitter rivals. They did not like each other. They met each other like in a drinking establishment. One little guy came up right in the face of another guy. And he goes, "Oh, oh." And it was a large Samoan lad who just calmly stared at his man, wiped the spit off his face, and just kept staring. And my kids are going, "Oh, oh." And I'm thinking, this guy just sent a message. This guy just sent a message. You spit in the face of a man, and he doesn't blink. He doesn't cower. He just looks at you. That's when the guy who spits should think I might be in over my head. I'm just thinking I might be in over my head. Isaiah also responds by saying this. He goes, "So his appearance was marred more than any man." That means disfigured. At this particular point in the trial, Jesus, his face has been beaten. It has bled. It has been struck to the point where it is considered disfigured. You would not recognize him. Pilate came out again and said, "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know I don't find any guilt in him." Could you imagine if he found him guilty, what he would do? He goes, "I don't find any guilt in him." Okay? Now, this is what's probably going on inside of Pilate. Pilate being a governor, military experience, passing judgment on people. There are Roman laws about what's right and what's wrong. He has a conscience, and he's sitting there and he's thinking, "Look, I don't find any guilt in this guy. And yet, in order to save my neck and to appease these people that want blood, I'm going to basically rip this guy apart and have him publicly humiliated, publicly shamed. And yet, I know that he's done nothing wrong." That has got to eat into the heart of a man. To go against his conscience like this. The turmoil, I believe, in Pilate is just ringing and ringing and ringing. He goes, "Jesus therefore came out wearing a crown of thorns, the purple robe," and Pilate says to them, "Behold the man." This is not a title of royalty, deity, or anything like that. I believe what Pilate is saying is going, "This one that you say believes himself to be your God, some kind of king. He has no followers. Everyone's deserted him. Here he is. He's a heap of humanity, bleeding, mocked, and beaten. Look, he's a man. Are you guys now satisfied? You can't even recognize the guy. And he says, behold the man. Now I want us to pause at this moment, because what do we get out of this? Because so far the narrative has been a lot about what Pilate is saying, what the religious leaders are saying. What's in the heart of Jesus? What's in the heart of Jesus? What are some takeaways that we can get? First of all, Jesus takes the reality of sin extremely serious. Jesus, the perfect Son of God, knows that sin is not something that is to be played with. It's not a trifle thing. It is serious. It is deadly serious. He also takes the issue of sin and the reality of sin extremely personally. There was one remedy for the sin and the darkness of mankind, and it was him, a perfect sacrifice. He knew that. He was not a martyr coming to give himself away and to die for a revolution. He came to offer himself as a sacrifice for the sin of mankind, to die. He knew what was coming. That's why in the garden he did pray, hey, Father, if there's any other way, can we go with plan B? No. Then he said, not my will, yours be done, I'm going. He takes the issue of sin personally. He didn't delegate this to someone else. He didn't write a check to pay for it. He paid for it personally. And the other thing is, through all this, please keep this in mind, Jesus isn't afraid of anyone. Jesus is not cowering, as we will see, as we have seen. Jesus is not afraid. He is going willingly, and he isn't afraid of anyone. When therefore the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, crucify him. Crucify him. You would think, would you finally be satisfied with your hatred of God, that you would see this man ripped apart here before you? Would that be enough to satisfy your hunger and your depravity? And the answer is no. They want more. They want him crucified. They want him publicly executed for everyone to see. They want him naked outside the city for everyone to see him agonizingly die. They want to send a message. The heart that is in rebellion against God, it will never be satisfied until it turns its heart towards God. You give the angry and the rebellious in their march against the one true living God, you give them an inch, they are not satisfied. They want more. They not only want you to be fined for not catering their wedding, they want you out of business. They not only want to censor you in the halls of academics, they want you ostracized and out. They not only want to quiet your school Bible study, they want you punished for your school Bible study. They don't want you to not only not to mention God in the political arena, they will mock you, they will demonize you, and they want you out altogether. They will not back down until they give themselves to the one true living God. Pilate again says, look, take him. You want him dead? You do it. Crucify him, because there's no guilt. This guy's got an anxiety disorder that is just raging within him, I believe. You take him. I'm done. The Jews answered him and said, we have a law that by that law he ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God. They're coming back to that because earlier they said, you know what? We found him blaspheming and our laws say that he should die. And they said, well, then go ahead and kill him. That's your laws. And they said, we can't. And that's a lie. Because the Jewish law said if the penalty for blaspheming was what? It was stoning. Remember early in the gospel narratives that Jesus goes into the temple and he was invited to come up and unroll the scroll and read from Isaiah, and he read the prophetic scriptures about the coming of the Messiah, that he will preach good news and he will bring sight to the blind and he will bring care for the poor and those sorts of things. And he rolls it back up and he goes, I tell you, in this day, it's being fulfilled. He was just declaring, this is about the Messiah, I'm him. And it said that it was at that moment they tried to throw him off a cliff, which was many times the precursor to stoning. They wanted to kill him, but it said Jesus just walked away in their midst. Yeah, they could kill him, but they didn't want their hands dirty of this because they didn't want to stone him. They wanted him crucified, and only Rome could crucify him. Pilate's got himself a huge, huge predicament going on. See, it says when Pilate heard this statement, he was the more afraid, which translates, he was terrified. He was terrified because I believe that at this point in time, he's saying, you know what? These guys are hell-bent on blood. And if I don't give them what they want, I'm going to have an insurrection on my hands that's going to be citywide, and then my butt is in the fire. That's not in the original text, but you get what I mean. He knew his job was on the line. He's got a major problem brewing, and he thinks he's the only one that can fix it. So look what happens. So he entered into the Praetorium again, okay? The Praetorium is his private residence. It's the residence of the governor. This is where he lives. Now, it's getting to be preparation for the Passover, as we'll see later on. It's somewhere between 3 and 6 in the morning. In the other gospel narratives, it says that the religious leaders, the Jews, they didn't go in with him because they felt, since it's preparation for Passover, if they go into the house of a Gentile, they are then considered unclean. And they did not want to be unclean for the Passover. So they stayed out. So here's the situation. It's Pilate and Jesus alone in Pilate's house. There comes a time where every one of us, every man, has the opportunity where it's just you, the Spirit of God, and you're alone, and you're going to choose what you do with Jesus. This is one of Pilate's great opportunities. Look what happens. He goes, they entered into the Praetorium, and he said to Jesus, where are you from? I don't believe that Pilate is saying, what's your return address and what's your zip code? You see, Pilate has been listening to these conversations go on. Jesus has already said, I'm a king, but not of this world. There is truth, and it's found in me. I have been sent from above. In one of the other gospel narratives, it says that it was at this time, or shortly before, he gets a note from his wife that says, I had a dream about this man, speaking about Jesus, and it terrified me. And she said, have nothing to do with this righteous man. I believe that this was another opportunity that God gave Pilate to say, you know what? Jesus is going to die, but it doesn't have to come through your hands. This is one of those great spiritual truth, men. Listen to your wife. Okay? I'm going to pause so the ladies can write that down in the notes and maybe circle a verse. Just say, hey guys, I got a verse now, okay? He should have listened to his wife. Now, it was not, you know, that she ate Mexican after 10 o'clock at night and had bad dreams. This, I believe, came from God. Because it said, have nothing to do with this man. He's a righteous man. She said, he's righteous. Don't do anything. I think Pilate is starting to understand that this guy that he's with in his own private residence, he's starting to wonder, I don't think you're from here. Are you one of the gods? Are you the one God? You see what Jesus answered him with? Nothing. Nothing. Say, why did Jesus... If this is true, if Pilate's really starting to ask questions and maybe really, really, really seeking, and Jesus says, nothing. What does that mean? Is Jesus vengeful? I think one thing is silence. Silence is definitely speaks strength and courage. He says nothing to him, just looks at Pilate, nothing. The other thing is that when we look in the scriptures, is that often when it says that God was silent or God was quiet, judgment came. I think that's the message that Jesus was giving to Pilate. Pilate, you've seen enough, you've heard enough. And if someone say, well, why didn't Jesus just give him one more chance? Look, Pilate, look who's standing before you. How much more does Jesus have to show you that he is willing to take on sin personally for you? How much more? How much more do you need before you'll finally listen? Judgment is coming. You know, for some of you out there, you know, it's easy to come to church and sit in a crowd and not be noticed. But maybe like this time right now, or maybe in the past, or maybe sometime in the future by God's grace, it's going to be you and God's Spirit. And it's going to ask, and he's going to ask you, what are you going to do with Jesus? Not what you think about him, not what others say about him. What are you going to do about Jesus? Because your answer will greatly affect the trajectory of your life from now on and into eternity. Here's what we see what happens with Pilate when he starts to get squeezed. Pilate said, you don't speak to me? Don't you know that I have the authority to release you and I have the authority to crucify you? I think Pilate is a coward here. Pilate is hiding behind his position. The reason why is he goes, don't you know I can release you or I can have you crucified? Well then, Pilate, if you have that authority, okay, why don't you release him? Because you've said 6 times so far you don't find anything wrong with him. The reality is, Pilate, you're a coward. You know what's right. You're not going to do it because you're going to cave into it. And what you're going to do, to save your neck, you're going to sacrifice your own soul. And men do that. We compromise, we spin facts, we hide behind authority figures or our titles or our positions, we get so puffed up with ourselves when in reality, we're like Oz behind the curtain. We really are cowards at that time because we won't stand for the truth. Jesus said, you would have no authority over me unless it's been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me up to you has the greater sin. He's already said he's a king, but not of this world, that he came from above. Pilate's barking about his own position, his title. And Jesus said, you know, the only reason why you have that is because I gave it to you. I'm the one who's in charge here. Remember, through this whole thing, Pilate's starting to freak out. Jesus isn't afraid of anyone. And he goes, for this reason, he who delivered me up to you has the greater sin. Jesus is declaring, you know what, this is going to go down. But there are going to be degrees of judgment. Those that delivered me up to you, they're guilty of more heinous sin. Says as a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him, because I think Pilate's probably thinking, well, if there's greater sin for those that delivered him over to me, what would happen to the one who then crucifies him? Pilate is now thinking, I got to get rid of this guy. But the Jews, they cried out and they said, if you release this man, you're no friend of Caesar's. He's bringing in Pilate's boss now. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. The Jewish leaders are now doing the political spin, and they are tightening the clamps on Pilate. They're saying he claims to be a king. Anyone who makes himself to be a king opposes Caesar. Anyone who releases this one who opposes Caesar must then be guilty. They are putting the squeeze on him like you can't believe. And I think Pilate knows, if I don't go through with this, there's going to be trouble here. Pilate therefore heard these words. He brought Jesus out, sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of the preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. That's about 6 a.m. He said to the Jews, all right, behold your king. You say he's a king? Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar? Okay, behold your king. They therefore cried out. They said, away with him, away with him. Crucify him. And Pilate's like, you want me, you claim he's a king, you want me to crucify him. Look at this. The religious leaders, the one who had the temple training, the one in the religious garb, wearing all the religious bling, the nice hats with the degrees, the religious leaders who are to somehow help the people in the relationship with God, they cry out, they say, we have no king but Caesar. He is our king. The pagan, multi-god worshiping, claims he's a god, he's our king. As these religious leaders are also being squeezed, you're finding out that there is nothing but hypocrisy, hatred, selfishness, and the spin of the news cycle. They are in it totally for themselves. They are corrupt, absolutely. They're being squeezed. Pilate's being squeezed. And Jesus is being squeezed. The religious leaders, their allegiance is to themselves and their corruption. Pilate's allegiance is to his political welfare and his job and himself. And Jesus is pledging his allegiance to the truth. Jesus is pledging his allegiance to his Father. Jesus is pledging his allegiance to us, to save us. Behold your King. Behold our King. Do I take the reality of my own sin seriously? Or do I still play with it, coddle it, excuse it, spin it, nurture it, sleep with it, drink it, shout it? Do I take the reality of my own sin personally? Do I take Jesus seriously? Have I taken Jesus personally? Or am I just playing a religious game? Who do you pledge your allegiance to? When we were in Haiti a couple weeks ago with our team, and Dave Kirk went around, he asked some of us, he goes, why do you follow God? One young lady who had a real rough upbringing, abusive father, such like that, she said, I finally found a father who cares for me. Another young lady, bunch of kids, busy young mama, she goes, I found security, someone who loves me. And he goes, Doc, why do you follow Jesus? I said, I got a hero. Finally, a cause, a person that's greater than myself that I can follow. Someone who will grip my innermost being, someone that I can pledge an allegiance to, something worthy to give my life to. Men, do you remember when we were younger and we had heroes? Do you remember that? We saw them in comic books, maybe on TV. We tied towels around our neck as capes. We wanted to be the good guy. We wanted to defeat evil. We wore Superman underwear. Some of you still do. It's okay. But as we grew up, where are our heroes? We've made mere men our heroes on the TV screen and in the sports arena. And we've made Jesus a game. Who's your king? Who do you pledge your allegiance to? We're going to have the praise team come up. We're going to take communion. And we're going to start passing out the elements. In the early church, they took two parts of Christian life that are outlined in the scriptures, baptism and the Lord's table, communion. And they referred to them as sacraments. And even today, we refer to communion as a sacrament. Sacrament comes from the Latin word sacramentum, which was an oath that a soldier took. When a soldier declared his sacramentum, it means, I will obey the orders of my king. I will not desert the field in honor of my king and the mission he's given me. And third, I will not even fear death in carrying out the mission that my king has sent for me. In essence, when a soldier took his sacramentum, it was a pledge of his allegiance to his king. Sometimes, people, we have taken communion and we've toned it way down. Some of you think it's kind of cute, tasty, and has no real significance. It is your turn. It is your time, Christian, when the one true living God is saying, I've pledged my allegiance to you. Where and in whom do you pledge your own?